Hello, and welcome to the HoganCast, a weekly podcast where we discuss a variety of subjects. Each week, we talk about a different topic, from literature to travel and everything in between. Our episodes strive to be both conversational and informational, and our occasional interviews are hopefully entertaining. Thank you for joining us, and we hope you enjoy this week's episode. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the HoganCast. It has been a long, long time since I recorded an episode. I apologize for that. There's been a lot of things kind of going on, and I kept meaning to come in here and record an episode, but I just did not have the time. So I apologize for the long wait in between. It's not my intent to take so long, but, you know, everything just kind of got in the way of recording a new episode. So I am back now. For episode, I believe this is episode 9. It's actually episode 8. Sorry about that. We're almost at 10 episodes, which is pretty exciting. I'll try not to wait so long between this episode and the 10th episode. I guess that's kind of a milestone to have 10 episodes of your podcast. So I'm pretty excited to reach the 10th episode, and I'll try not to make it another 6 months or whatever it was between episodes. So the last episode that I did, I just kind of shot from the hip and talked for about 30, 40 minutes about West Virginia. And while I'm not going to talk about West Virginia this time, I do kind of want to approach it the same way. I had some decent feedback from the listeners that I do have that contacted me and said they really liked the way that episode went. So hopefully this one will be a good episode as well. One of the problems with just kind of shooting from the hip is that there's a lot of and you know, a lot of filler words that I have to go back and edit out later. But, you know, it's fun to do the editing. Usually it takes just about as long to edit as it does, well, actually longer to edit as it does to actually record the podcast episode itself. So sometimes I have to wait till the next day to do that. It is what it is. You know, I have to make sure that I get as many of those out because I, you know, even when I'm speaking in class or when I was a teacher, and even when I'm doing public speaking, I really have a bad habit of losing my train of thought or inserting filler words here and there. Even when I'm just having a regular conversation, it has nothing to do with like being nervous or being under pressure or anything like that. It's just something that I do that's a bad habit that I'm trying to minimize. But for now, it's still a part of what I do. I've done it like 20 times already. I'm aware of it when I do it, but it's hard to not do it. So I usually go back and edit at least some of those out. So this week, I kind of want to talk about interpretation, like how we interpret things, maybe a little bit about allegory. But I want to start off by talking a little bit more about music. I did an episode, not last episode, maybe the episode before that, where I just talked about the Beatles documentary for the entire episode. And in that episode, I talked a lot about the music that I like to listen to, what kind of I have is, you know, what grooves me. And I talked about some of the artists I really like, but like, I don't like just only old music. I like catchy songs. You know, I like songs with a catchy hook. I think Neil Diamond writes really great choruses. I mean, if you listen to Sweet Caroline, that's just like one of the catchiest choruses of all time. Same thing with like Suleiman or Holly Holy, Cherry Cherry. All of his songs have like really great hooks. So I like catchy songs. I like catchy hooks. Some artists that I like that are not 30 or 40 years old, some modern artists, I really like Lady Gaga. I think she writes really good hooks, really good songs, catchy songs. I like Blackpink, even though I don't really understand most of the words. The music that they do is really catchy and really really good. And I like Lisa or La Lisa, I guess now that when she's solo, but particularly from Blackpink. I think because she is Thai and she's singing in a South Korean pop band, pretty much, I think that's really impressive because she speaks Thai, she speaks South Korean, and she speaks English really well, really good as well. So really well. I really think that she's pretty talented. I like Dua Lipa. I think her songs are really catchy. Besides being catchy, I really like songs that tell a story. I like ballads. I like Marty Robbins, like the El Paso trilogy. I like epic songs like Stairway to Heaven or the Battle for Evermore is one of my favorite Led Zeppelin songs because it's kind of Tolkien-esque in its lyrics. But a lot of times I kind of look at singer-songwriters as being like the peak of the music industry, like people who write and sing their own songs. And it's very rarely that I think like a cover version of a song is better than the original, but there's a few. And I'd just like to talk about just briefly, because it kind of goes into the rest of the podcast, like not allegory, but just the way we interpret things differently. And that's, there's a song called Mr. Bojangles. And Mr. Bojangles is a pretty old song. It's from the 60s. It was originally written by a guy named Jeffrey Jerry Walker, I think is his name. And it's a true story, kind of. He was in a prison in New Orleans. He was in a jail cell, and he met this street performer who was given a fake name. He's calling himself Mr. Bojangles, so the police wouldn't really know who he was. And, you know, telling everybody was in there talking, and he started telling this story about his dog that he had had for like 15 years or, you know, he just went everywhere with the dog. And then the dog died. And like, obviously, it created a really heavy mood in the jail cell. And someone said, oh, man, lighten up the mood a little bit. So he said, okay. And he tap danced across the jail cell. And he took that name, Mr. Bojangles, from a guy named Bill Robinson, whose stage name was Bojangles. And he was like the most popular African-American performer of his day. He was really like a famous tap dancer. He was the highest paid African-American entertainer of his time. Unfortunately, by the time he passed away, he didn't have any money left. And Ed Sullivan from like the Ed Sullivan Show ended up paying for his funeral. But he used that name. And after Walker was released from prison or whatever, he wrote this song called Mr. Bojangles. And the song kind of blends what really happened with the idea that, because the guy that was Mr. Bojangles, or saying he was Mr. Bojangles, was like a street performer. He wasn't like in the minstrel shows like the song says, and he was obviously white, not black. But Walker wrote the song as if he had met like this old minstrel show performer. And some minstrel show performers were blackface and they were white, but a majority of them were African American. And so he wrote it from kind of that perspective that he had met this old minstrel show performer in prison. And he told this story about how, you know, he worked throughout the South, him and his dog traveled, you know, so he took that piece of the story with the dog, you know, for 15 years throughout the South. And then he says, and the dog up and died after 20 years, he still grieved. That's the lyric. So like he took some elements of what actually happened in the cell and kind of embellish them a little bit, fictionalize them a little bit. And so this song was not super popular. He released his own version. It wasn't like super popular then. Then the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, who were pretty big country stars at the time, they released a version, and it was pretty popular. But the most iconic version is by Sammy Davis Jr. And, you know, when I first heard it, I assumed wrongfully that Sammy Davis Jr. had written the song, because it's just so... Sammy Davis Jr. is from that world. Like he became, like we know him, most people know him from the Rat Pack with like Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin, but he was famous in that era of like tap dancers. He was one of the more popular African-American entertainers himself. I think he knew Bill Robinson as well. So I thought that he had written the song himself, or like a situation he might have found himself in, or at least something he could imagine. But he didn't write it, but he really dug the song, and it became like kind of his go-to song, like one of the songs he was known for. And if you have a chance and you like any Rat Pack music or anything like that, or even just stories, songs that tell stories, just YouTube like him giving the performance, and you can kind of watch like when he's young, like in the 60s and 70s, he does a version. And then even like in the late 80s, when he's in his 60s, he's still singing it. Like there's a YouTube video of him in Berlin doing it. And he acts it out. So like when, you know, he says, oh, he danced across the cell, he'll dance across the stage, and he jumped so high and then he clicked his heels. Like Sammy Davis, like actually, even at 60, he could do that. So, and he gave an interview, and he said like to him, the song was about not like the guys like Bill Robinson and himself that got really famous from that era, you know, and were able to be successful, but all the guys that were maybe better dancers than them or better entertainers that didn't make it, that weren't chosen, that didn't get famous. Like he said, when he sang it, he thought about all those guys that he knew that didn't make it and found themselves in situations like in jail cells, dancing for tips in honky tonk bars. That's probably the song. That's a lyric from the song as well. And that's why he loved the song, and he started doing it in all his shows, and it became kind of associated and iconic for him. So like, that's one of the cover versions of songs that I think is definitely better than the original, just because of how much it connects to Sammy Davis Jr., even though he didn't write the song, like how closely it parallels, not his life, because I mean, he was a huge star, but like people that he knew that were in his circle at one point, and he could like really relate to those friends of his that didn't make it. That kind of goes to kind of how we interpret different things or how we interpret music and literature differently just by who we are. And one thing that you'll do if you ever teach literature at high school or junior high level, you'll talk a lot about how to interpret texts. Like what does this mean? You know, they're pretty famous, not really famous, but there's some funny memes out there. Like, you know, the writer's in a blue room. So in his book, he says, oh, you know, she was in a blue room because he was in a blue room. He just looked around the room and said, the color of the room was blue. And then it says like, okay, high school English professor, like, oh, he made the room blue because his mother was a prostitute and his sister died of tuberculosis and his youngest son fell out of the window when he was a baby and died. And so the blue represents like his horrible life and things like that. So maybe like, you know, he was sad, but that wasn't necessarily the reason. And you'll learn that different colors mean different moods or emotions. Like, you talk a lot about that. You'll talk allegory in a lot of different texts. Some of the more famous ones are like the Divine Comedy, like Dante's Inferno, and then you go Paradiso or Inferno, Purgatorio, and then Paradiso. That is an allegory if you read it as most academics want you to read it, and it is an allegory for the soul's journey to heaven, right? So in Inferno, that's the most famous part of the Divine Comedy, right? He goes to the nine circles of hell. He's led by the poet Virgil. Beatrice, who is like this girl, this is a real girl. Beatrice is a real person that he met a few times when they were young, and she died, but he always loved her. Virgil's his guide, but Beatrice is also kind of his guide at certain points. And Virgil represents reason, like man's reason, logic, his brain, his intelligence. But Beatrice is divine love. So Virgil leads Dante through Inferno, through hell, and he leads him through purgatory, but he can't lead him through paradise, to paradise. And that is because the thinking is, at least at the medieval time, that your intellect, your reason alone could not get you into heaven. There had to be a divine love or some kind of love for the divine and reciprocated divine love to actually get into heaven. So Beatrice is that divine love, that divine presence. Your intellect can help you recognize sin, which is what Inferno is, if you believe the allegory. It is the recognition of sin and then rejecting that sin. By making it through Inferno, he's rejected that sins. Purgatory is leading a penitent Christian life, or like a living your life in a Christian way. But in the end, to get to paradise, for the soul to ascend to heaven, there needs to be that divine love. And that's what Beatrice is. If you've read even just Inferno is like what most people will read, or at least you'll read excerpts from it in high school or something like that. There's a lot of symbolism. Like, for example, I told you that Beatrice is divine love and Virgil is reason. But at the beginning of the story, there is a lion, a leopard, and a she-wolf. The lion is pretty obviously representative of pride. The she-wolf is representative of greed. And then the leopard is representative of lust. And the lion's obvious, but the she-wolf is because she's so always eating, greedy. She's, you know, she eats everything. The leopard is kind of described as beguiling and lith and like all these kind of sensual terms. So that's been interpreted to be lust. And there's a lot of other things. One other really cool aspect of Inferno in particular is this idea of contrapasso, which is Italian for suffer the other. So what that means is whatever you did that was sinful in life, you'll be punished the opposite way in death. So like, for a good example is like people who were fortune tellers in life, they have their heads twisted around backwards as punishment in hell. It's a really, really interesting story. What's cool is that in the original Italian, the lines rhymed a bit, but obviously when you translate it to English, it doesn't. But if you have a chance and you have an interest in literature, read Inferno at least. I mean, everybody talks about Inferno. That's where all the references are from. Very, very few references ever come from Purgatorio or Paradiso. But the entire Divine Comedy is a really good read. With all that being said, did Dante mean that? Like, did Dante intend for the Divine Comedy to be an allegory for the soul's ascent into heaven. As far as I'm aware, he never said that that was the case. It fits extremely well, but of course it has to fit or nobody would have believed it in the first place. And now we take it almost as fact for a lot of these allegories. And a good example of when it was wrong and the author was still alive to say it was wrong was when Tolkien wrote The Lord of the Rings. A lot of people said it was an allegory for the Second World War. The One Ring was the nuclear bomb. And Tolkien said, no, that's completely wrong. That's not what I meant at all. And I don't write allegory. I wrote a mythology for England, pretty much is what he was doing, or how he described it. And so he said, any allegory that you find was not my intent. It's just your interpretation. And that's not to say that interpreting literature in a certain way is wrong. You should always try to find meaning in literature, I think. But when you are teaching lit, a lot of times you have to present these allegories like they are 100% what the author intended. And we don't know. For the most part, we don't know. Let me talk about a story that I think is one of the best examples of an allegory without actually knowing 100% that it is an allegory. And that's The Mask of the Red Death by Edgar Allan Poe. For those of you that have never read it, The Mask of the Red Death is this story about Prince Prospero. Now, Prospero is, if I'm not mistaken, Italian for fortunate one. That's an ironic name, which you'll see as we go through the story, or as I give you, I'm not going to read the whole story, but I'll summarize it. You'll see that Prospero is an ironic name. And by ironic, I mean that someone with the name Prospero, you would not expect what happens to him to happen to him. But I don't want to get too much into irony because I think that would be like a really cool episode by itself because there's so much to talk about with irony. There's different types of irony and people misuse the term irony quite often. So I don't want to get too far into irony, but there's a couple things that are very ironic in the story. Number one, obviously Prospero's name. Number two, that they, you know, everyone has locked themselves away into this castle for protection and that ends up actually undoing them, you know, like being, well, let me summarize the story real quick. So in the story, Prince Prospero, there is this disease called the Red Death that is like sweeping throughout the land. And instead of helping his people as a prince should and governing his kingdom, Prince Prospero decides to invite, like, I think it's 1,000 of his closest buddies and friends to his castle. And they pretty much seal the doors and they're going to party until this plague has passed them by. And that is their plan. So they lock themselves in the castle. And in this castle, Prospero decides to hold a masquerade ball one night. And he's going to entertain his guests. There's these 7 rooms and he's going to have a masquerade ball. He's going to decorate each room differently. So each room is a specific color. The first one's blue and then the next one's purple, I think green, orange, white, and violet. And the last one is black, but either the stained glass or the curtains of the glass like cast this scarlet light on it, so it looked like blood, right? So already, if you were in a horror movie, nobody would go to that room. And that's what happens. Like, during the masquerade, nobody wants to go in that room. And also in the room, there's this big clock, right? This big ebony clock. And every hour, it chimes. And each time it chimes, like, everybody just freaks out and stops dancing. The whole party just stops. But then, after a few seconds, everybody's like, oh, that was silly. Why'd we stop? And they start dancing again. And they feel so embarrassed that they stopped. And they say, next time that clock strikes, I'm not going to stop dancing. I'm just going to keep partying. But each time it chimes, everybody stops dancing. Now, party goes on and on. Everybody's having a wonderful time. And then at midnight, everyone starts to notice that somebody... Let me go back up just a little bit. So everybody wore like these really crazy costumes, like these really sexually suggestive, like offensive costumes. And everybody got a kick out of it. Everybody thought it was hilarious. But then at midnight, they start to notice this one guy. And he's in a dark robe that's just like kind of covered in blood. And he's got this mask on his face that looks exactly like your face looks when you die from the Red Death. Now, Prospero thinks even like in this party where people are wearing like the most offensive costumes possible that this guy went just a little bit too far. And he gets really, really angry and he decides that he's going to go find out who this guest is and hang him. Well, at first he tells the guest, go grab him, bring him to me so I can hang him. But the guests, they're cowards. They won't do it. And he passes through each chamber right by them, all the way through the six chambers. And Prospero finally just gets his own courage up because he didn't move either. He's also afraid. He gets his own courage up and he pulls out his dagger and chases the guest into that seventh room where nobody wanted to go. And he's about to kill the guy, but then the figure turns around and Prospero just falls dead. He screams and falls dead. Now, the revelers, like their prince is dead. This guy just killed them. And now they're going to make sure that he suffers. So they're scared, but they all rush together, strength in numbers, and they remove the mask and the robe only to find out that there's nothing in it. There's nobody inside the mask or the robe. It's empty. And only then do they kind of come to the realization that it was the disease that came to the party and everybody dies. And it has one of the best closing lines in any short story. And that is, and darkness and decay and the Red Death held illimitable dominion over all. And that's just such an awesome way to end the story. That is The Mask of the Red Death on the surface. It's a story about a crappy prince who locks himself in the castle to hide from the disease. And then everybody ends up getting the disease anyway because it comes into the castle. But there are a lot of interpretations of the Red Death. That is an allegory for man's journey through life. And each room is symbolic of like a stage in life. I think it's from the Bible that there's seven stages in a man's life. I'm not sure. I don't have it before me, but I'm pretty sure that's what it is. And so like the blue room would be birth. Purple would be youth. Adolescence would be green. Adulthood would be the orange room. Then old age would be white. When you're about to die, violet, which I don't really know what's different between purple and violet. But anyway, and then death itself is the black and scarlet room. Obviously, the horrifying room that nobody wants to go in. And you have that clock. And that clock is always ticking. And it's ticking as a reminder that one day that clock is going to strike. And that's going to be it. That's when everybody's going to die. And it's a reminder, always reminding you that every time that bell chimes, you're a little bit closer to your last day. And that's why everyone stops when the bell chimes, you know, and they're a little bit scared. Time is running out, right? That means you're getting a little bit closer to the end of your road. So that is an allegory. And also, if we take it like that, it also is didactic. It teaches us a lesson, right? It's almost moral in a sense. But Poe did not like stories that taught lessons, according to him. He didn't like didactic. He didn't like literature that was trying to be moral and teach you right from wrong, according to him. So that kind of undermines it a little bit, but man, it fits so good. I mean, it really, really fits. And Poe was very intelligent. He used irony a lot. He used a lot of literary devices that are not as up for debate as allegory. So if anybody maybe did it, like for sure, I would almost say Poe, just because it fits so good with this story. But when you also take into account that he didn't like too much allegory or morality lessons in his stories, maybe not. But there's another poem by Poe that's also kind of like an allegory, and it's called El Dorado. So I'm gonna read you El Dorado straight through, and then we'll just kind of talk about it just briefly at the end. So this is El Dorado by Edgar Allan Poe. Gaily bedight, a gallant knight, in sunshine or in shadow, had journeyed long, singing a song in search of El Dorado. But he grew old, this knight so bold, and o'er his heart a shadow fell as he found no spot of ground that looked like El Dorado. And as his strength failed him at length, he met a pilgrim shadow. Shadow, said he, where can it be, this land of El Dorado? Over the mountain of the moon, down the valley of the shadow, ride, boldly ride, the shade replied, if you seek for El Dorado. That's a really cool poem. It has a lot going on in a very short. So one of the first things you'll notice, maybe you didn't notice it because I was reading the poem, but if you were reading the poem yourself, is that the knight is actually aging in the poem. So early on, he's gaily bedight. That means really nicely dressed, like in his shining armor. A gallant knight in sunshine and in shadow had journeyed long, singing a song in search of El Dorado. So there he's young. He's looking for the city of gold. He's, you know, He's going to find all these riches and his life's going to be great. But he gets old and, you know, he starts to despair because he hasn't found El Dorado. And then eventually he sees a shadow, which is a ghost. And he asks, where's El Dorado? And the shadow says, oh, you have to go over the mountains of the moon down the Valley of Shadow, which if you read that line, the Valley of Shadow, that's from, you know, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I shall fear no evil. So pretty much what the shade is telling him, like he says, ride boldly, ride, the shade replied, if you seek El Dorado. He's saying the only place that you're going to find El Dorado is in death. But if we look at it from a different perspective, more as like an allegory or metaphor, we could be seeing that, you know, you can go through all your life, waste your life searching for riches, trying to get rich. Like, you won't really find true riches until you've reached heaven. That's one interpretation of the poem as well. All right. But even not as that, it still kind of serves as just saying, you know, like, it's just a really cool story of like this guy searching for El Dorado forever until he dies. You know, there's a deeper, I won't say deeper, we always say deeper. The interpretation as a metaphor or allegory, extended metaphor, is much more interesting, especially if you're teaching a class. Because if you're just going to read the poem and not try to find deeper meaning in poems or short stories, it makes for a boring class. And so I'm not against allegory or metaphor. The only thing I'm against is when you have to present it as if it's 100% fact. A lot of times what I would tell my students is, this is what the book wants me to tell you, and this is why, this is how the book looks that way. But can you find anything? What does the story say to you? Like, if you read El Dorado, what do you find in the story? Do you agree with the interpretation? Is it parable almost, or not parable, but is it, you know, trying to teach us that earthly riches aren't really important? And the only true riches are in heaven. Is that what you think, or do you find something else? You know, and we talk about it. And even for me, like, a lot of times when I would read poems and even some short stories the first time, I wouldn't necessarily get out of it what the book told me I should get out of it. I could see what the book was saying, why it said I should get that. But is my opinion worth less? Like, am I wrong, or is my interpretation just different? So that's kind of why I wanted to just touch upon, talk a little bit about those few topics there. Going forward, I think I might do a few more like this. I talked about irony. I really like to just do an episode on irony. I like talking about, you know, literature. It's just really hard to do literature if I haven't read the story in a while. I have to go back and reread it, and, you know, or at least reread the synopsis to make sure I remember everything correctly. Something short like El Dorado I can read right there. And The Mask of the Red Death isn't that long either. You should really read The Mask of the Red Death. It is one of the best short stories ever. If you haven't read it, you should definitely read it. Poe is not an easy read. He likes to use a lot of difficult words, but, you know, you'll get past it. So The Mask of the Red Death is one of my favorite Poe stories. That and The Fall of the House of Usher, which maybe we'll talk about another time. And, you know, The Divine Comedy is a tough read, but it's worth it because it's an all-time classic. But I just wanted to kind of touch on allegory and metaphor and just how we interpret things differently. And it doesn't mean you're wrong because you don't have the standard academic interpretation of a story, because a lot of these metaphors and allegories were thought up by people years after the author had died, or they came about because they wrote a master's thesis or a PhD thesis on their interpretation of a story, and it just became the popular opinion. Doesn't mean it's right. Sometimes they change. Most of the time it'll fit, because if it doesn't fit, then it doesn't make sense as a metaphor or an allegory. So once you see it and you're like, oh, okay, yeah, that makes sense. But that doesn't mean that's what the author intended at all. So that's always important to keep in the back of your mind, that we don't really know what the author wanted. So most of these allegory or metaphor interpretation, just general interpretations of literature, are just that. They are opinion. That's why you can read literature from so many different perspectives. Like, you can critically analyze anything from a certain perspective. You know, there's LGBTQ interpretations, there's Christian interpretations, there's whatever, any kind of background that you come from, you can apply your analysis. You can critically analyze a story based on your background, and that doesn't make you any more correct or more wrong in regards to your interpretation. Whatever the story says to you, or a song says to you, or a poem says to you, is just as wrong, just as correct as what anybody else says. If you can back it up by saying, okay, this is what the author said, and this is what I think he means because of that, why not? Why aren't you as correct as anybody else. I enjoyed talking about this today, and maybe we'll do some more literature-themed episodes in the future. I have to go back through and listen to this and see like how many and buts I have to edit out, and there was one right there, you know, and see if maybe I need to plot things out a little bit more in the future, because it's just so much work editing all that stuff out. But I definitely think maybe the next episode I'll talk about the different types of irony and how irony plays such a vital role from like the beginning of real theater, in particular the Greek Western theater. Irony is such a huge part of like Oedipus Rex, for example. It's such a big part, and it's just never left us. So maybe we'll get into that next week. Thank you for listening. I apologize again for taking so long between episodes. If you want to reach out, you can, you know, shoot me email over at thehogancast@gmail.com. We're on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. You just search The Hogan Cast. Maybe it's been a little bit quiet lately, but it's still there. So thank you very much, and I hope you have a wonderful week. Goodbye.